Seafood is having its day in restaurants everywhere, including in Kansas City, but sustainability of seafood is a part of the whole fish-eating experience that we don't love talking about. And seafood chefs, in particular, could be understandably reluctant to get people talking about the impact of seafood consumption. But the nation's chefs have actually been at the forefront of the movement to petition the U.S. government for more transparency in seafood sourcing, because they generally want to be able to make eco-friendly choices for themselves and their customers. This weekend, a preeminent seafood chef from New Orleans is teaming up with Jack's here in town on the plaza for a sustainable seafood pop-up event, and we're going to hear more about that now on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Sheila Lucero. She's the executive chef at Jack's Fish House and Oyster Bar. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Gina.
What's happening this weekend exactly?
We are hosting Chef Ryan Pruitt from Pesh, kind of throwing down a little pop-up party at Jack's, representing some of the delicious food that he has at Pesh. He's going to come out and cook with us, and we just kind of want to introduce Kansas City guests to Pesh, New Orleans-style cuisine, and sustainable seafood that we do at Jack's as well.
Well, we've got Ryan Pruitt on the line with us from Pesh in New Orleans. In 2014, Pesh got the James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant in America, and Ryan Pruitt has actually won the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the South. Hi, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing great.
Pesh is a seafood restaurant that was founded on the idea of sustainability, right?
That's correct.
Talk to me about what that means to you at Pesh specifically in New Orleans.
I think to sum it all up, it means being a responsible part of the entire chain. So from the fisher all the way to the plate, you know, that benefits us because we can acquire the freshest, highest quality fish for our customers. And we also want it to benefit everyone else that exists in that chain. If the finances don't work through the whole system, then the system will fall apart. So we try to work with our fishermen very closely to make sure that they're getting what they need. Of course, it has to work on our end, but we found that generally people are very open to working when the conversation is ongoing.
For those of our listeners who are really new to the environmental issues related to fish consumption, what are the main things going on? Can you give us some of that background?
Well, you know, it's very important to choose fish that are being harvested correctly at the right time. You know, it's important to broaden your sort of consumption habits, eat different varied kinds of fish. And then finally, very importantly, I think it's important that people consider the entire fish, so not just the fillet. There are other parts of the fish that are just as, if not more delicious than the fillet. And one of the things we try to do is introduce our customers to different cuts, like the bellies and the collars, and really try to utilize as much of the fish as possible.
But what is the concern? I mean, what is the nature of the environmental concern?
Well, the environmental concerns largely surround overfishing and removing species from the water in numbers that are greater than what they can sustain. So we try to be very cognizant of the fish that we're using and check with a number of different sources to make sure that we're getting enough of the scientific data to make the right decisions.
What kind of data? I mean, what is it that you're really looking at? You're looking at the rate of reproduction as compared to the size of the current population and amount of fish being distributed to restaurants and brought in by fisheries?
Yes, all of those things. And, you know, fortunately, we have relationships with various scientists and other groups that track that information for us. You know, of course, we can't go out and get that data firsthand. That requires a tremendous number of people. But we work very closely with a group called the Audubon Gulf Institute, and they do a lot of sustainability studies in the Gulf, and they really keep us up to date on the latest science. So we try to, whenever we purchase, we try to make sure that we're purchasing within their guidelines and using them as a sounding board when we come across different species that we're not familiar with.
But do you have a sense of the scale of the problem if, you know, absent these kinds of efforts?
Well, you know, I think that depends. Seafood can be a little murky, and I think it depends on your perspective. You know, I think the overall truth of seafood sustainability is that if you're buying American seafood, you're buying from the healthiest, best managed fishery in the world. And there's a lot of people that watch that, from local wildlife and fisheries agencies to various scientific foundations. All of these people are watching what's coming out of the water and doing their best to estimate impacts on the species. Now, it's not an exact science, but scientists have gotten very good at predicting when a species is in trouble and when we need to back off the harvest.
So, being a chef is an art, and I wonder if you can talk about what inspires you when working with fish, and then how the pressures around sustainability enter into that more creative side of the work you do.
Well, I think what's really what moves me at PESH is being a part of the entire chain, and it's been broadening my vision from just creating food, just putting fish on a plate and serving it, broadening out to look at where did that fish come from, who caught that fish, how was it treated after it was caught, and then if you take another step back, what laws governed that fish's removal from the water, and how does that legislation play a part in what I can serve to my guests at PESH?
Can you give an example of a law that you have just learned about in the process of digging into this and being more actively aware of it that you were unaware of before, and that maybe our listeners would be too?
Sure. I think that the biggest law that governs our fisheries in America is the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And really, it's just a wide-ranging, incredibly vast bill that governs all of the American fisheries. And we have done some work with various species that and laws that fall underneath Magnuson. But in general, this is a very powerful law that its introduction basically revived the entire American seafood industry and keeps it viable to this day. So Magnuson is something that we try to continue to work with, work for, understand better, and it's been a real rewarding experience to view what goes on the plate at PESH in the larger context of how the whole fisheries are managed.
So you were talking about that, you know, at one point it was like preparing the fish, putting it on the plate, and that now you've got this sort of longer story arc for each of those fish that you put on the plate. Can you pick a fish that you have recently served and tell that larger story of that fish as you now understand it? Okay, we just lost our guest, so we're gonna turn back to the guest in studio here, Sheila Lucero, who I introduced just a little while ago. She's the executive chef at Jack's Fish House here in town. Hi, Sheila, again.
Hello.
So when you think about that question, do you think about the fish that you serve in those same terms, like that it has this longer story and this larger relevance, where that fish comes from, how it was fished, who fished that fish, all of that?
Yeah, I think we really try to do our homework in the sourcing of that fish, and then bringing it to the plate, thinking about how it'll best be served to our guests. Our guests are curious. They want to know where their food's coming from. They kind of want to hear a little bit of that backstory. So really trying to do, you know, our due diligence in homework and trying to, you know about that fishery, that fisher. And through the supply chain, to be able to give that dish a little bit more depth and the story behind it.
So, for you, how curious are your customers here in Kansas City about sustainability, the sourcing of seafood, all of that stuff? Is there a customer demand? Do people ask about it a lot when they're ordering?
I think we're seeing more and more of it. I think now that we have been here for several years, that we've built some trust with our guests, and they do ask questions. I think more and more frequently, people, generally speaking, want to know where their food's coming from, and it's nice to tell a little bit of a story about how that fish or that seafood got to their plate.
So can you do the thing I was just going to ask Ryan to do, which is Tell the story of a fish you have served recently in those terms.
Sure. I'm trying to think. Let's do if out of the Gulf fishery right now, it's National Seafood Month, so we've been supporting the Gulf with some sustainable shrimp from the Gulf region, and we've been talking to different shrimpers in the Gulf. There's one in particular. His name is Lance. He supplies us with shrimp on occasion, and that's a really good. I've got to meet him. He's come to Colorado and come to Kansas City to do some slow food work and bring his shrimp up from the Gulf for us to enjoy. So he.
And where is he working in the Gulf?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, So shrimp is something that I'm curious about because one of the issues, if you're sort of like looking into questions about ethics and fishing and fish consumption, shrimp is a concern largely because of its relationship to slave labor in other markets. And it, according to reports I've heard, it seems like it is more likely that shrimp you consume here has been impacted by slave labor at some point in the chain, much more likely than I would have imagined. It was actually a pretty disturbing set of reports that came out. It was maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I can't speak to that specifically, but we do try and, you know, support those fishers and shrimpers that are doing the right thing by creating these relationships and, you know, following them along that supply chain. I think that the U.S., the domestic fisheries, have done a really good job in management of that. Right now, we use Monterey Bay Seafood Watch as a kind of our guiding light in who we buy from and who we purchase all of our seafood from. They do a lot of their science-based accreditations and assessments. And one of those assessments, one of the boxes that they check is on the slavery in a fishery and how they manage that as well.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back into this discussion about sustainable seafood with Chef Sheila Lucera of Jack's Fish House and Oyster Bar here in Kansas City and Chef Ryan Pruitt of the renowned restaurant Pesh in New Orleans. Call 816-235-2888 with your questions about eating seafood responsibly. 816-235-2888. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my guests are Sheila Lucero of Jack's Fish House and Ryan Pruitt of Pesh. That's a really acclaimed restaurant in New Orleans built on the idea of sustainability and relationships with fisheries. We're talking about making ecologically responsible choices when eating fish, whether you're doing that on the coasts or in the Midwest, and you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. I want to bring Ryan Pruitt back in on this discussion. Hi, Ryan.
Hey.
Sorry for our technical snafu. How did you get into seafood? What's your backstory?
Well, I didn't actually set out to be in seafood, quote. Really, when I moved down to New Orleans, seafood just permeates the culture down here. We're obviously very close to some very productive fisheries. So when I moved down here, I started becoming more and more interested in the stuff that was coming out of the water and learning how to use it, learning how it was harvested, and trying to understand just everything, including the culture around it.
What was most surprising to you as you started exploring that? Because with a Midwestern listenership, I think that the depth of knowledge the typical Kansas Cityan has about what's in the ocean, how it comes out, what all of the industry around that really is.
Well, I think the most surprising thing that I've learned over time is just how many varieties of creatures live in the waters down here. I mean, there is, you know, I think everyone knows about the standard things that you eat, like shrimp and oysters and tuna. But, you know, once you kind of move past that and the red snapper, there's just a whole wealth of different types of fish that are out there. Many of which weren't really considered commercially viable for many years, and a lot of which are kind of moving into the mainstream now, both due to pressure on other species and because people are actually eating them and realizing that they're delicious.
Is there a dish that you love to make that you've had to adapt in response to emerging knowledge about sustainability or new research that made you rethink an ingredient?
Well, I guess sort of. You know, I think one of the dishes that we really kind of hang our hat on at Pesh is a grilled whole fish. And it's a very simple dish. There's certainly many people have made this before. It's nothing new. But to me, it really sums up our entire philosophy with seafood. You know, we're sourcing this fish correctly. We're making sure that it's purchased in the right way. And then we're grilling it in its entirety so that nothing is lost. And again, one of the big sort of aspects of sustainability to me is just making sure that you're using as much of the product as you can. If we serve, buy, cook, and serve a whole fish, we're doing exactly that.
As you mentioned, being in New Orleans, you are near a number of fisheries. You can serve Gulf oysters that are fresh and local. Is that aspect of sustainability important to you?
Of course. I mean, we do everything we can to support all of our local fisheries. You know, of course, we rely on fish that come out of Louisiana waters absolutely the most, since proximity dictates that we do. All of our shrimp come from Louisiana. And for oysters, the majority of our oysters come from Louisiana waters. However, we do source from down the Gulf as well.
You know, you're coming to Kansas City this weekend, and that's going to be much further from the coast. I'm curious about what you see as, you know, once you're not speaking and eating and serving food in the context of Louisiana, in the context of a Gulf city, what you think that picture of relevance really becomes?
Well, anytime that we cook anywhere outside of sort of coastal America, and particularly the coastal South, my main mission is to bring dishes to people that sort of highlight the diversity and quality of species that we have on the Gulf, and then try to sneak in a little message about, you know, how important it is for everyone to make the right choice when buying seafood. You know, so when you're in the grocery store, making sure that you're buying American caught seafood is really the simplest and most effective way to promote what we have going here in America as far as quality of seafood.
Why is that American piece of it important? Is that a sustainability question, or is that an economic question?
Well, I think it's many things. You know, economically, when you spend your money buying American seafood, you're supporting a cycle that sends money into American populations. So, buying an American shrimp keeps that money in America and feeding the families and cultures in the shrimping regions in America. You know, it's also a health choice. It can be very difficult to determine the quality with which shrimp are raised or fish are caught when it's coming from international waters. Many countries don't have the same standards and rules that we have.
So back to this question about relevance in the Midwest. I mean, how do you define sustainability when you are sort of by definition far from most of the sources of the fish you're getting?
Well, I suppose it all becomes relative. I mean, you can't drive to the ocean from Kansas City and pick up your seafood. So I think one thing that I really have learned from working with people like Sheila is how you apply these principles to inland areas. And this is something that I'm still learning about, and I'm certainly no expert on it. I have the sort of luxury of being able to drive to the coast. Not everybody has that, and one of the things that I've wrestled with a lot is how do we spread sort of the message of American seafood, full usage, all of our pictures of sustainability into sort of non-coastal areas. So that's definitely something I'm still learning about.
Well, Sheila, this is a good time to turn back to you. Do you have to think about sustainability just a little bit differently as someone who specializes in seafood in Kansas City, knowing that the people you work with aren't going to be just a drive away for you to sort of pop in on casually from time to time.
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't have that face-to-face connectivity that I think that Ryan may have, but we are, you know, we have a lot of really great relationships, and we still want to be able to introduce our guests to different types of species and get them to understand that there's more out there than what they're used to seeing. Like, we like to think a little bit more outside of the box and try and get them outside of the, you know, the tuna and the salmon and start to like really get out there and see these other species that could be possible bycatch to another.
Why is that important to sustainability? Because it sounds almost like if people are like inspired to eat more and more fish, that's more and more overfishing. And I don't think that's what you're getting at, but I'd like that clarified.
Yeah, I think, you know, the diversity of, there's so much stuff out in the ocean. There's so many different species of seafood and fish. We wanna tap into that so that we aren't, you know, overfishing one certain type of species, and we're kind of broadening our palates and getting people to understand there's a lot more out there. And you know, that I think maybe a little bit more challenging for inland states just because they don't see those species of fish quite as often. So trying to get that, I think, is what we're working on or working towards.
I also do wonder about the speedy shipment of fish. You know, people want that very fresh fish. That's part of what accounts for the seafood boom, I think, as far as people being more open to it and interested in trying it, no matter where they are. But then when I think about the word sustainability, I think about that carbon footprint that might come with that.
Yeah, that's definitely a question that I've been getting a lot recently. And I think, you know, we're really conscious, our business as a whole, our model as a whole is, you know, being really mindful of the things that we source, not just seafood, but everything else. And then also trying to offset some of those impacts by doing things like compost and recycling and wind power and those kinds of things that can kind of offset our carbon footprint.
So I want to get into just a couple more specific issues related to seafood sustainability, because these issues are really complex and go beyond overfishing, which is most of what we've talked about. And one issue, as I understand it, is the mislabeling of fish. And in some cases, it sounds like outright fraud when it comes to what kind of fish we're being sold. Some studies a few years back published in Conservation Biology found a startlingly high percentage of the sushi served in LA when tested was not what it purported to be. And I guess red snapper in particular was found to be pretty darn suspect. Ryan, can you speak to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's a tremendous problem. And whenever you have a high value species like a red snapper, you know, sort of disingenuous actors are going to try to sell other fish as that to make more money. Now, again, we're able to sidestep that issue entirely because we know where our fish is coming from.
And, like, you know them personally.
We do. And we do. And, you know, additionally, we buy most of our fish whole. And there's really no way to hide what it is when it comes in, you know, fully intact. Not everyone has that luxury, but, you know, I think that, you know, at some point you have to trust your sources, and hopefully the people that you're working with are behaving honorably.
You know, the nuance of marine ecosystems is also worth considering, that it's not just a species-by-species question, that you can't entirely view what happens to one ocean species as unrelated to what happens to another. And I'm really pretty intrigued by the story of sea urchin and sea kelp. Ryan, is that something that you're informed on?
Not at all. We don't have much urchin and kelp down where I am.
Is that something that you deal with, Sheila?
More kelp. I mean, in California, the time that I've spent at Monterey Bay, talked a lot about the benefits of kelp in that water and how fast it grows and what it does for the ecosystem. Outside of that, that's...
Well, sea urchin eats the sea kelp, and so that's an example of an interesting scenario where the increasing popularity of a fish species on the dinner plate actually has an environmental benefit in that they were destroying the sea kelp. I don't know. Anyway, that was of interest to me. But are there other examples where it's not as straightforward as it might sound?
I mean, I think the big one in the Gulf right now is lionfish, where we've had the introduction of an invasive species, started as a sort of an aquarium fish that released into the wild, and they just sort of rampantly reproduced. And so now...
Oh, we just lost Ryan again. I'm so sorry. Sheila, before we go, we'll be going soon, but I love fish, so this whole question is really kind of hard to reconcile. But clearly, as a seafood chef, you are just the furthest it could be from advocating abstaining from fish. What are some resources you recommend for people who like fish, but not so much that they're going to turn a blind eye to the issues that have been raised in this conversation?
I think, for those guests that are that love seafood and want to support sustainable fisheries, and it's really just all about doing your homework, asking questions, talking to your fishmonger, and try cooking this at home as well.
Sheila Lucero, thanks so much. And thank you to Ryan Pruitt as well. Their two restaurants, Jack's Fish House and Pesh out of New Orleans, will be teaming up on a sustainable seafood pop-up this weekend, October 18th through 20th. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now it's October. Some people may be talking about pumpkins, but I want to talk about bats because I think they're cool when they're in the sky. And then any closer than that, and they really freak me out because of rabies. This is the time of year when I start to see them up overhead. And for a split second, I'll think it's a bunch of birds up there. But then I'll notice that they're all kind of flying erratically in different directions, and they're screechier than birds. And I'd like to be a little less freaked out when that happens. I suspect some of you are there with me. So now, before we go, what's the deal with bats? My guest is John Harmer, a naturalist and bat expert at Lakeside Nature Center. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. You have this interesting program where you rehabilitate injured bats, and so you know them up close and personal. Can you talk a little bit about the work you do in a really hands-on way with injured bats?
Oh, absolutely. Well, as you say, I'm a staff naturalist at Lakeside Nature Center. And one of the things we do at the center, which is very unique for us, there's not many places in Missouri that do this, we are a wildlife rehabilitation facility. And that means just about every native species of animal here in the state of Missouri comes through our doors at one time or another, either abandoned, injured, a lot of times for no particular reason other than somebody thought it was in need of help. And one of those species that we get are bats. And we actually have 9 different species of bats here in the state of Missouri.
What typically causes the bats you encounter to be injured in the first place when they are in fact injured?
Well, actual injuries, believe it or not, are very few. Or I should say very few injuries make it into us. Because obviously bats are very small. And once they're not able to fly, they are open opportunity for predators to get to them. A lot of times it's caught by cat. Now here again, this might be a bat that for some reason is already debilitated because it's down where a cat can get it. Ends up inside somebody's home. That happens quite often. And then it's a matter of somebody swatted it with a broom or did something a little bit more than what a bat is able to handle. Those are the main injuries. And then the physical injuries to the bat themselves, like I said, if it gets swatted, concussions, broken wings, because they are, we like to, handling them ourselves, we know they're fairly sturdy, but, getting hit with a broom, we can imagine getting somebody smacking us with a table. It can do enough damage that they do require some help.
So before we address the fears around bats that lead people to swat them with brooms, let's start with bats 101, as in the very basics. Pretend I'm a fifth grader.
All right. And I actually have a couple of those programs coming up here pretty soon to do. Well, the thing with bats, for instance, why do we associate bats with Halloween? They're creepy. They're out at night. They're
It's easy to make that costume, too. Let's be real.
It is true. It is true. I actually have a bat costume that I use in my program. So, yes, it is easy to do that. Bats tend to, just by their natural movements, tend to freak us out. As you were pointing out, you know, at night or dusk, if you happen to, a lot of times you're not even sure you're seeing a bat. You simply see this small dark object dart in and dart out of your field of view.
Yeah, like flits around.
Flit. Actually, that was an old English name for bats, or flittermouse.
Whoa.
Yeah, but most people don't see that one coming. Yes, flittermouse. So
they are flying mammals, and I'd like to address that because it is weird also when you think you're seeing a bird and then you see teeth.
Yes. And if you've ever seen one up close, they give you, and we've all seen the vampire bats in movies and things like that. Well, if you were to see one of our bats, and all of our bats here in North America, specifically here in Missouri, they are all what's called microbats. They're the largest, doesn't have a wingspread, barely of 16 inches. But if you look at one up close and personal, they have little sharp canine teeth. They're adapted. They're all insectivorous. Their job is to catch insects, and that's exactly what they do. So, yeah, if you were looking one, I mean, within inches.
And their ears stick up.
Oh, yes. Everything you can possibly imagine to, you know, put humans on the wrong side of the fence with them is what they do. If they do end up on the ground and you see one, just like the name suggests, they skitter. They have a very awkward, because they're not designed to be on the ground at all. They have an awkward movement on the ground. The wings, I mean, just about everything, you know.
They're nocturnal, right?
They are nocturnal species here again. They're out at night. We're not a nighttime species for the most part. So it's just one more thing out there we don't seem to know much about that could get us.
What do we know about bats? It's like one of the most interesting things you have observed in your daily interactions with bats or learned from bat research that most of us would never have any reason to know.
One, bats are very intelligent. With us working with them, and we typically do throughout a season, and a season we're talking from January 1st, 2019 to January 1st, 2020. It's a year-round process. We actually see that bats, like all other species of animals, and here again, this is things that people just don't seem to be aware of, they're very intelligent, but they have unique personalities. Not just simply, you know, the what we're used to of, you know, they're hurt and angered or they're calm, but they do play when they're young, and they do recognize who feeds them. they're very long-lived, which is very unusual for a small mammal. Most small mammals, high metabolism, they burn up a lot of energy. They're kind of the candle of burning both ends. Bats can easily, most of our species can easily make it to 40 years old.
40?
40 years old, yeah. Which in and of itself is really great, but and I'm sure we'll talk about it here shortly, but it also leads to some issues that concern people too.
So this is the rabies thing.
The rabies thing. And the rabies thing is always going to be brought up when we talk about bats.
Why? Why bats in particular?
Okay, well, bats are what we call a rabies vector species, along with raccoons and skunks. Now, any warm-blooded mammal can carry rabies. We can carry the rabies virus. But these are the top three. That the main reason that, because bats especially, because you can think of a bat colony could have anywhere from 5 to 500, maybe 5 million individuals in it. And we're talking shoulders.
Can you go back up and define a colony?
A colony, now, here again, depends upon the species of bats. Not all bats live in colonies, or what we call a roost, is the physical location they're at. We have two different types of, now, all the bats we have here in North America are insectivorous, and they are small. They're called microbats. But we do break that down to where we have what we call foliage roosters. Now, these are bats that live in trees. We have several different species. They're pretty solitary for the most part, other than when they breed. And a majority of them do migrate out of here in the wintertime. The others, use an example, the big brown bat it's the most common one we have here in the metropolitan area. This is the one you find in your attics and basements and things like that. These are the guys these are the ones, like I said, you might have a colony of 5, you might have a colony of 500, you might be lucky and have 5,000. The sky's the limit with that. To give you an example of a large colony, in San Antonio, Texas, Bracken Cave, which is a cave system down there, has the largest known bat colony in the world. It's approximately between 4 to 5 million Mexican free-tailed bats that fly out of there every evening. So, like I said, they are the crevice dwellers are colony animals. They do seek companionship, and not only sometimes with their particular species, but you might have big browns, little browns, an evening bat, you know, several of the others that will get together because, you know, they love the company and the warmth. So, yeah, a colony can be just about anything.
Crevice dwellers are like that.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's you should be expected.
So, should we? You were talking about rabies, though, and how the size of colony is related to the threat of rabies.
Yes, because when you get those high in numbers, what happens is that it's very easy for the virus to get spread, and not only just within a colony, but bats, you know, once a colony gets large enough, individuals go to, you know, fly and go find another range. They end up in other colonies. It's actually, and not to get off rabies, because rabies is obviously, as we're all pretty much aware, it's life-threatening. There is no cure for it.
But not to bats, right? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, it's threatening to them too. They can be a carrier, or they can actually develop. It's called shedding. They shed the virus. They can actually develop the symptoms of rabies. It's neurological. A bat with rabies is a horrible thing to see because the poor thing. They're in incredible pain. They can't eat or drink. Like I said, it's neurological. You know, their wiring is just shot. And the good thing I can say about it is we do not run into that many cases of it. My wife and I, like I said, she's a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. I'm staff. We've been doing this for a little over 17 years. In all that time, approximately 100, 150 bats a year, we've only had one confirmed case of rabies, and we've had two that we suspected.
But is that confirmed carriers or confirmed?
Confirmed, actually had the disease.
But then bats can also be carriers.
They can be carriers, and there's why that runs into why. When people call us or bring a bat into the center, matter of fact, just before I came here this morning, two bats came into the nature center. I'll be working on them when I get back. There's quite a list of questions that we'll go through with individuals to determine if there was a possible, any type of possible contact that could lead to exposure. Because like I said, it is life-threatening. And some people just aren't aware. They think, well, I didn't handle it. Well, one of the very first things we ask, especially if it's been found in a house, do you happen to have any infants or elderly, anyone in that house that could get bitten and not realize it?
And not be able to tell you.
Exactly. And usually in a case like that, the very first thing, even if the bat's been brought to us, just because, like I said, rabies is a very serious thing, we will go ahead and send that bat in for testing. And unfortunately, the only way to test for rabies in any mammal, they have to take a brain sample tissue, and the animal has to be euthanized. So there's no way around that one, unfortunately.
Should we be afraid of bats? I don't mean phobia level, like can't leave the house type fear. I guess I just mean a healthy respect for dangers they pose, including rabies, but maybe there are others. I don't know.
Well, in all honesty, and I point this, actually, when it comes to any wild animal, we should have a healthy respect for it and leave it alone. Nature does just fine without us. Matter of fact, it does a wonderful job without us. But unfortunately, we come in. That's what we do at the Nature Center, is handle animal-human conflicts and try to educate. But with bats, if you just take rabies out of the picture, just like any other mammal, there are many different types of parasites and diseases that they carry. And some of these can easily be transferred to humans, or worst case scenario, they have things on them you don't want on you. So it's always best to, and like I said, bats especially because of the danger of rabies, but any wild animal, enjoy them for what they are. Sometimes you may get to see something you may never see again in your life. I said, I do wildlife rehabilitation. I'm a naturalist. I've only seen two bobcats in my whole life, one in another state and one here. And they're a common animal, but they're very reclusive. You may never get to see this animal again. Enjoy it for what it is. It is a wild animal. And we a lot of our education is helping people understand the difference between an animal that's been domesticated and something that's wild.
So
don't touch.
With bats in particular, you mentioned that you and your wife take care of them. You do this in your house.
I heard an earlier promotion for this on the radio, and they mentioned we have bats in our house. Yes, we. Matter of fact, of all the different animals that we do as wildlife rehabilitators, and we do all the squirrel species, groundhogs, skunks, I can list more. Of all those animals, only the bats are the only ones we bring in the house. When we first decided we were going to do this, we went in all the way. We built a facility on our property. We can do just about everything we can do at the Nature Center except for the number of animals. But bats, we do bring those in. Reason for this is because they, in our opinion, they do take quite a bit of care. And during the spring, when we've overwintered bats through the winter, in the spring, we will have babies. And we really keep it's kind of like if any parent knows, if you're in the bedroom, you're listening all night long for that cry, and you're going to jump up and run in there and see what's going on. We do the same thing. If we hear some little babies might be squealing, we go in there to make sure it's in the right pouch with the right mom and nobody's picking on it. And, you know, we can monitor the heat and mud and keep that change a lot easier in our home than we can. And when we very first started doing this, we actually, because one of the things we do before a bat is released back out into the wild, whether it's an injury or overwintered, we have to make sure that it can maintain flight. And there's an actual time limit, 20 minutes, that we want to see constant flight.
It seems like once you know something has been flying for 20 minutes, it's gone.
Well, true. How we start out in that is we built a flight pen. It wasn't very large. It was adequate for what we did at the time. But we actually would bring bats in our house and fly them in our house. My wife would have a pillow at one end of the room. I'd have a pillow at the other end of the room.
This is like a children's book in my mind.
It was interesting. We would, because especially with young bats, sometimes the parent they weren't picking up the skills that well for mom and dad, so they brought them to a bat flight class, which is pretty amusing for one species that can't fly trying to teach another that can. But we would fly them in our house. Sometimes they would miss the pillow, end up in the flowers, all sorts of things. We have cats too, so the cats had to take a break and go in another room. We eventually built a large flight pen. It's 30 feet by 18 feet by 12 feet.
Is this in a backyard or something?
In back of our property. And like I said, we actually have a facility. I have, as of right now, and I'm getting ready to add some more species-specific caging, we have 15 different cages, outside caging, for different species of animal. And we built a flight cage so we were getting some of the larger species of bats, we have to make sure they're able to fly. And sometimes, and that's when if you can imagine 20 or 30 bats in a cage all flying at the same time, and you're trying to monitor which ones are staying airborne for 20 minutes, it's a lot of late nights in a lawn chair with a little red light. And
but how do you teach a bat to fly as a non-flyer?
That one brings up questions. Well, fortunately,
I've seen you move. You walk on two legs. I can confirm it.
Well, fortunately, instinctually, they know how to do it. That's the good thing. They know how to do it in a sense. But like anything, you got to get them to get up there and do it. Sometimes that takes more effort than you would imagine. They, for whatever reason, and here again, it can go back to an animal's personality. They're timid. Maybe some noise may be bothering them. Maybe the temperature may be affecting them.
Helped a bat overcome its shyness and to get it to fly?
Well, honestly, we have, and there's different techniques. One of the most important things is, because like I said, most of these bats, depending on species, are colony animals. Getting them in with others of their species, they pick up on, if this bat goes over and finds a source of food and keeps going over there, well, maybe that's the place to go eat. So other guys will follow suit. So having them around members of their own species helps greatly. And a lot of times with our young, like I said, we don't have to teach them all to fly, but we'll get the individual straggler. But usually in the spring, once we have everybody out in the flight cage and we have the juveniles out there, they pick it up. They see everybody take off. And one of the neatest things we get to see when they're young is what we call wing stretching. And this is a prelude to them starting to fly. They'll start stretching those wings out just as far as they can, and they haven't flown yet, but they're like, oh, this feels good. And usually within a day or two, they'll launch themselves and off they go.
Let's talk to Chris and Olathe, like like you, Chris has a bat house. Unlike you, I don't think he's a professional wildlife rehabilitator, but Chris has a question for you that is very specific to having a bat house at home. Okay, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, Chris.
Tell us about your bat house, first of all, because I didn't know this was a thing people did.
Well, it's a wooden box. It's on the back side of my house, the south side of the house. It painted it black so it retains the heat, and bats have taken up root there.
Fantastic.
So what is your question?
Which is fine. Well, the question is they poop directly... I guess their poop goes directly down from the house onto the windowsill of the window below it. And I wonder if that's safe for me to, what's a safe way for me to clean that off?
And this actually, this is a problem folks run into, sometimes not even having a bat house, just an existing colony that's underneath an eave or behind siding or a shutter. And yeah, this happens. Well, the first thing is whenever you have, whether it's up in your attic or a situation you have, you don't want to go about this barehanded. The bat poop or guano can carry whatever the bat was carrying, obviously. Definitely want to have on gloves, and I always recommend putting a face mask on. You don't want to breathe this in. A lot depends on the homeowner. I know people who are just so happy to have bats that they don't care where they poop. They will go out there, glove up, face mask, clean it off every day if they have to.
So this is a common hobby?
Well, I want to call it a hobby. I suppose there's worse things out there. But like you say, you've put up a bat house. You've got a colony. You've got bats there. That is fantastic. Because that's harder to do than most people realize, is get bats to actually use a bat house once you've put it up. As far as the guano itself getting rid of that, there's a couple things you might try to do. One, like I said, if you're happy with them being there and it's not a great, chore to do, yeah, I'd be out there cleaning it up. You might even put some type of a ledge or something there where it catches it or diverts it. Another thing you might do is and I'd almost do this as a last resort, is move the bat house enough one way or the other to maybe where it goes off into the shrubs or, you know. But, oh, gosh, I'd live with the poop.
All right. So different options there.
And just a hose, good old garden hose, yes.
What are the joys of having a bat house and observing bats in this way? I'm guessing that the observation of bats is why people would do this, the ability to just be surrounded by them?
Well, for me, absolutely, and for a lot of people it is. But mostly people are aware that the benefit of having bats is because the more bats you have in your neighborhood or you're in your own bat house that you've put up, is you're going to cut down on the amount of mosquitoes you're going to be dealing with throughout the summer. And it is absolutely true. An adult healthy bat, depending on the species, can easily eat its own weight in insects in a night's time of hunting. And not just mosquitoes, flies, moths, wasps, pretty much anything that flies that they can handle that's out at night, they will eat. So that's
goodbye, citronella. Hello, bats.
Yeah, they are very beneficial to just the average homeowner, to the neighborhood.
Also, they are pollinators, right?
Well, they can be. Like I said, most of our species, all of our species here in North America, like I said, they are insectivorous. They don't eat fruit. They don't eat anything but insects. The pollinators, now we're talking about what we call the megabats. Ours are the microbats. The megabats, and now we're talking about the guys that you'd see in the movies, vampire shows, Indiana Jones, things like that.
Only not fiction in this case.
Not fiction in this case, but these guys don't live in North America. You'll find them down South America, Africa, Indonesia. These are the guys that can easily have, you know, 3.5-4 foot wingspan. These are the fruit eaters. And obviously, with that, they are excellent pollinators because when they go to the fruit, you know, they get the pollen on them. Here, our biggest benefit with our bats is the amount of insecticides that they help us not use by out there doing it naturally.
Do you have a favorite bat?
Well, honestly, I love them all because they're each unique and different. But one of my absolute favorites, and we had one for an education bat for about 6 years, and that's the hoary bat. They get their name hoary from the coloration of their fur. It's beautiful, and they tolerate people fairly well.
Well, our time is up, but John Harmer of Lakeside Nature Center, thanks so much for all your bat expertise.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me here. Appreciate it.
This morning's conversations will both be online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, tune in for a show about legendary musician Bob Dylan. He's coming to Kansas City this weekend as people get psyched about that. We are curious about the Dylan fans from up-and-coming generations who relate to him and his music on their own terms. That's tomorrow. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rell with help today from Ann Kniggendorf and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.